Thanks, Alex,
for the invitation. And yeah, so today I'm gonna tell you about a topic that really underpins a lot of modern developments in this interface between quantum information and quantum gravity. And this topic is the Birkinstein bound. Patrick and I in this work is gonna sort of add a new spin to the old story from a quantum information perspective. All right. So what is the Birkinstein bound? So we all know that information is physical nowadays, but back in the old days, it's not so clear. But Birkinstein bound provides one of the first evidences, perhaps on par with the Landauer principle that illustrates this key point. So the original motivation for the Birkinstein bound is that Birkinstein was thinking about the black holes, and he argued using basically just thought experiments that in order for black hole to be consistent with second law of thermodynamics, any box of certain energy E and size R better not contain too much of information, because otherwise, if you dump this box into a black hole, sort of lowering the box adiabatically through the horizon, you wouldn't increase the entropy. Well, when the box is absorbed by the black hole, its area is only going to bounce back, determined by the energy and the size R. You would need the entropy disjoint from the outside of the black hole to be smaller than the increase of the area of the black hole if the area measures the entropy. So he just deduced from this consistency with second law that the entropy must be smaller by up to a constant by this product between R times E. And this bound actually involves nothing about gravity. So this constant has nothing to do with G Newton, and it is therefore conjectured to be universally true in any relativistic point of view theory. But immediately after this sort of heuristic argument, people realized that it's actually very hard to pin down exactly what the statement is. Because in quantum field theory, it's a non-trivial matter to precisely define these terms. And a widely accepted proof, or rather say a formulation of the Birkinstein bound, was given by Cassini in 2008. He proposed a precise formulation in terms of the relative entropy. So he made the following observation that if one considers the relative entropy between an excited state rho and the vacuum, denoted here as omega, over a spatial region, right? So you consider the relative entropy of the reduced state over the region O. And this quantity is, of course, always positive. And you can do this dirty trick of just expanding them. Although this is not exactly true in quantum field theory, but let's assume some lattice regularization. So you can do this expansion. You just write down the definition of relative entropy in two terms. You realize that it's an entropy term, and another term has to do with minus log of the vacuum state, which we define it to be something called the modular Hamiltonian. And if this K term is really a Hamiltonian, then this bound read something like the entropy being bounded by the energy. It is of the Birkinstein form. Here, an important subtlety is that in quantum field theory, when you lift the lattice regularization, both terms are infinite, approaching infinity. So you have to regularize the quantity by subtracting the vacuum counterpart. So you add and subtract on the left-hand side the vacuum contribution to this energy or entropy. So this is what this delta means. And then, you know, this bound essentially just follows from the positivity of relative entropy. So to give you a nice example, if we pick Minkowski spacetime and this region O to be the Rindler wedge, then the modular Hamiltonian does really look like a Hamiltonian, and it's just an integral of distance times the stress tensor. So it is something of the form that Bekenstein originally envisioned. All right, so to have a feeling about how this bound actually imposes a limit to information, let's consider a very illustrative example. Let's consider piling up entropy in a wave packet in Minkowski space, right? So let's say we fix the energy of the wave packet or every other quantum mode of the wave packet, but we add entropy without increasing energy by introducing simply more particle species. Let's say we make, you know, D copies of the free scalar field theory, and the particles carry different color indices, as indicated here in the diagram. And then if, you know, we just create this weird packet with an unknown particle excitation, so we don't know what the species is, this way increase the entropy, right? So if we describe the entire mixed state by rho, this entropy of rho should grow like log d if we increase d. And now we ask, what if we now put this weight packet in the right Windle wedge, right? So what about this entropy of rho over r, so which is the reduced state on the right Windle wedge? Naively, if you expect the if the wave packet is well localized, you expect the answer to be the same. But Bekenstein bound also said, if you imagine the right Windle wedge being like a box, he also said that there should be somewhat of limit to this entropy, so it shouldn't grow like log d. So this is sometimes known as the species problem or a particular version of it. And it is resolved in this particular case by Merov, Minnick, and Ross in 2003, before Cassini's general argument. And they show that the volume entropy of such a mixed state, in this case rho over r, it will keep increasing with log d until it gets capped off by the Bekenstein bound. So when this entropy, in particular this vacuum subtracted entropy, when it is about to surpass the bound, you will get capped off. And the reason is that at large d, the thermal excitation that an observer that only sees the right wedge basically means this observer will be accelerating. So this observer will describe the state as rho r. He will also see a lot of thermal fluctuation from the onward radiation. And when the species number is too many, he simply cannot tell the difference between a true signal that you need to distinguish these states versus a false signal that pops out of the thermal fluctuation. And one can check that the relative entropy when d is large is close to zero. So this means that the bound is enforcing, it is kicking in, and this information is saturating. In more information theory terms, you can think of different species encodes a different kind of a logical state, and these code words are slightly overlapping, and this overlapping might be small, but when this number of species get large, they have an overall effect to cap off this entropy. So this will be a illustration of how this bound works. All right. So now everybody is very happy about this Cassini's result and how we should think of the Bekenstein bound really as a statement about states' distinguishability. However, it is unclear in this general statement what kind of information is being bounded. Because this statement of positivity of relative entropy is not quite of the form that Bekenstein envisioned, unless you do this trick of expanding them into two terms. And once you, let's say we can do that trick with some lattice regularization, and the quantity you have is the von Neumann entropy, right? So von Neumann entropy, we know that operationally describes it characterizes the task of compression. But this operational meaning becomes somewhat obscure after you take the vacuum subtraction. In particular, when you do this, when you look at the Cassini bound and do the vacuum subtraction, it can happen that both terms of this Bekenstein bound are negative. So you could have a state that is less entropic than the vacuum. And then in this case, it's tricky to interpret what really is the information being bounded here. So I won't do better. So the question is, could there be other versions of the Bekenstein bound that are both operational meaningful and the quantity involved are UV finite, so you don't have to put in by hand some sort of UV regularization? Since von Neumann entropy is just one way to describe information, and it is generally not so well defined in QFT, so maybe we should look at other information theoretic quantities, and hopefully there can be a Bekenstein bound for those other more well defined quantities, yeah. So this work is trying to address this question. Okay, so let's look at a operational task that people has examined before in the literature. So this is not a new question. So this people has looked at other possibilities in the literature already. And a primitive task in quantum information is to distinguish a bunch of states. So let's follow Cassini's idea and look at the so-called accessible information that one can gather from an ensemble of states. So let's consider a particular task that Alice will encode a classical message that is denoted here by this classical random variable X, she will encode this message into the quantum field state by acting locally with local unitaries supported over her spatial region O, and she would just pick the right unitary indexed by the message X, act, pull this unitary out of the box and act on the vacuum. So depending on the message X, you will get a different sort of excited state that are locally created by Alice's action over her region. So and now you can ask if Alice just does that, then comes Bob, who tries to decode this information to read out X from the quantum field theory state. How much information can Bob have? So the figure of Mary here is the so-called accessible information, and it is defined by the optimal mutual information between the classical variables X and Y, where Y here is the random variable that Bob measures. It's known that this quantity generally doesn't have a closed form expression, but it is upper bounded by a much easier to deal with quantity that is known as the whole level information. Here I show you this definition of whole level information. Basically, if you have the ensemble of states, well, in this case, rho x is are just the reduced state of this global pure QFT state over the region O, and the rho bar is just the total mixture over this ensemble, where this px is dependent on your classical message. The whole level information is just given by the average over the relative entropy between rho x and rho bar. So manifestly, this quantity is well defined in quantum field theory because the relative entropy is generally well defined. So you don't need a priori a regularization procedure to make it well defined, like in the case for the volume entropy. Right, so Boussot considered this quantity, and he derived a Birkenstein bound on the whole level information, which in this particular scenario, in this particular task, we considered is just saying that the accessible information is bounded by the whole level chi, which is further bounded by this average over relative entropy. Now you just change the reference state to the vacuum. Which in this case were actually equals to the upper bound that the Cassini wrote down, which is the modulo Hamiltonian energy evaluated on this rho bar state, this mixture state. So actually, it's a simple exercise to show that this bound, this inequality here, simply follows from Cassini's bound. But when written in this version, it's a positive operational meaningful quantity chi being upper bounded by something, by another positive term that has this meaning of energy times distance, as we have seen in say the Rindler case. And the only difference here is that we do not regularize the if we think in terms of Cassini's bound here, we instead of doing the vacuum subtraction minus, you know, S of the vacuum, the vacuum entropy, we do a different kind of regularization by subtracting the average entropy of these code words. It does the same job of regularizing the infinity, but now if you do that, you will get the whole level chi quantity. So it seems like in this viewpoint, we simply just change the way of doing the regularization. And yet we get a much more sensible statement out of it. Right. So this the upshot of this quantity that is that it is operationally meaningful and UV finite by itself. So you don't need to explain how to make sense of it. It is itself a sensible statement. Right. So this accessible information, of course, is just one example of a larger family of information theoretic quantities known as channel capacities, right? So we are motivated by this Boussot argument, and we believe it's fruitful to just continue Boussot's study of the Birkenstein bound by looking at a task that has to do with distinguished states, or maybe even more generally communication, and we can use tools from quantum channel theory to help us. So in the end of the day, we hope that maybe we can look for Birkenstein bound on different channel capacities that are perhaps potentially better alternatives to the volume entropy used in the standard Birkenstein bound. So that's our motivation, and this is the end of the first part summarizing what we have known about the Birkenstein bound in the literature. So do you guys have any questions? Okay, so if not, let us proceed to the second part, which is our study. So unlike the Cassini's effort in addressing the Birkenstein bound, we're not looking for a very general statement about the bound. Instead, we focus on a particular example, a particular setup, namely a setup in Rindler space, where we have enough control about how to handle the quantum field theory calculations. And hopefully we can learn enough insights from this particular example. All right, so the scenario is to consider communication in Rindler space. Okay. Now let's consider the scenario between, of course, Annalise and Bob, and we have a stationary Alice who sees the entire space, and accelerating Bob who only see a window wedge because he's accelerating, and Alice wants to communicate with Bob by sending a wave pulse that I'll describe in the quantum field theory. So the question is, how much information can they communicate in this way? Now we model this communication scenario as a so-called unruly channel. This is a particular channel that one can consider, in which Alice will encode the message as single particle excitations in an unruly mode of distinct particle species. So unruly mode is just a particular mode that whose creation and annihilation operators share the same vacuum as the Minkowski mode. It's a global mode that Alice can, in principle, create. And what she does is just that she choose based on her message. She choose to excite a particular one particle state in this mode in a particular particle species, right? So let's say she has access to so D species, and based on the message, she would just try to excite one particle of that particular species. And then Bob will, of course, not see everything. He will only see the reduced state on the right window wedge because he's accelerating. And another way of saying it is that he will not see a clean signal, but he will see a signal immersed in the noise of unruly radiation. So this channel is noisy. So the channel is described in this way, is characterized by a few parameters. The first is, of course, the input dimension. That is essentially the species number that Alice can access to, D. And the channel also characterized by the energy of frequency of the mode that that Bob sees. And also Bob's local unruly temperature beta, and beta in this relativistic units is simply also the distance from Bob to the horizon. So the sort of beta here gives you the notion of the size of the box, and omega give you a notion of energy. Right, so this channel is parameterized by these three numbers. Okay, so we want to study the capacities of this channel, right? So this
Sorry, I have a
describes, yeah.
question just on the last slide. So should I think of this as like Alice encodes her message within some time window, or can she keep sending messages at later times, or
Yeah, we didn't particularly study like a dimension. So in this description of a channel, it doesn't have a part describing a dynamical evolution
okay.
of the thing. So it's a bit of a simplistic or idealized situation. So this unruly mode is just a particular mode of a given frequency. So think of like a plane wave mode. And it's not quite a plane wave mode, but Alice just created a mode of given frequency, and Bob will trace out part of that mode. And so I would say the evolution part is perhaps implicit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
But in principle, one can model that. We just feel like that would be an extra complication, so to speak. Yeah. Right.
Kingdao, can
Yes.
I ask a question?
Yeah.
So you said Alice send a signal to Bob, and this signal is the unruly mode of a free boson.
Yeah, let's say yes,
Yeah,
yes.
but Alice itself, it's she's not accelerating, so how could she create such a mode?
Yeah, that's right. So this has to do with the subtlety. So, here in this picture, maybe it's a bit of a misleading. In this picture, Alice can only create something like a Minkowski mode, whereas Unruh mode is a much more crazy mode than Minkowski mode. So, for those of you who may need a reminder, so the Unruh mode is something like a Rindler mode. A Rindler mode is only supported in the wedge, but the Unruh mode is like an analytic continuation of the Rindler mode over the entire spacetime. Unruh mode is not something that a localized Alice could prepare, but we can imagine, in principle, a bunch of Alices scattered non-locally over this space. They engineer an Unruh mode for Bob. So in this case, I'm not restricting any power. Let's say I'm not restricting any ability of Alice's encoding. I'm only restricting Bob's ability to decode. And it turns out that the Buckingston bound only pertains to the decoding rather than the encoding. So that's why I'm allowed to do that, or at least that's why I want to consider this situation. But
I see.
I didn't have a chance to describe why the Buckingston bound only pertains to the decoding, and yeah, so in this situation, I'm not restricting Alice's encoding power.
I see. Thanks.
Thanks for the question. This is in this sense not a strictly speaking operational scenario because Unruh mode is hard to prepare, it's going to be a proof of principle sort of thing. All right. Given this channel, which we can mathematically describe, I didn't write down formulas, but you can find formulas in the paper. We can basically define all these, evaluate all these capacities. So what are these capacities we're interested in? We're interested in the classical capacity, quantum capacity, and also the entanglement-assisted classical capacity. I will not repeat the textbook definitions of these guys here, but roughly speaking, they are defined as the optimal rates to transmit classical bits, qubits, or classical bits with the help of free entanglement over IID users of the channel. We know that generally channel capacities are additive, are super additive. That means that when you have multiple access to the channel, you can try to exploit the encodings to allow yourself to have entangled code words to help achieve a better rate. This limit, this IID limit, sort of characterizes the optimum rate of message of data transmission that you can have. For high energy physicists, it's very analogous to the large N analysis that they do. Often this IID results give you cleaner formulas than the one shot. The more operational one-shot counterparts. So we're going to focus on this asymptotic channel capacities. So operationally, when we say whether the classical bits, C bits here or qubits bits obey the Buckingston bound, we mean that whether these capacity quantities are constrained by the Buckingston bound. By the Buckingston bound or not. All right. People, I bet you know that these guys have nice formulas, but usually these formulas involve a regularization. I mean, a different kind of regularization as to the notion I'm talking about. In QI literature, when we say regularization of information theoretic quantity, we usually mean that we need to take n copies and divide it by n So this limit of taking n to infinity is like the so-called regularization. The regularizations, usually we deal with multi-letter formulas, but in this case, it turns out that this unruly channel has many nice properties, such that all these capacity formulas that we care about are single letter. So they have, in other words, additive capacities. And that makes our lives much easier. So it's much easier now to evaluate this quantities. And some of this capacities, for example, the quantum capacity has been studied in the literature before. So people has looked at the unruly channel before, and well, they have different motivations, nothing to do with Birkenstein bound, but they also evaluated something like the quantum capacity or the private capacity independently in the literature. All right. So I will not bore you with these formulas. They are not particularly important, but roughly speaking, the capacities are given by the whole level information, coherent information, and mutual information, respectively. And you can check that these quantities are all finite without any need of vacuum subtraction, as in the case for the Wonderman trip. So these are good candidates that one can ask the natural question whether they are Birkenstein bounded or not. And also another technicality is that in evaluating this capacity formula, one has to do a maximization over the states, and this is also straightforward given the fact that there's some symmetry properties of the channel. So the optimal state that one used to evaluate this quantity are often just the maximally mixed or the maximally entangled state. So it's a straightforward calculation. All right, so these are what we want to calculate, and these are the results. So we plot, we have two plots here, which shows what are these capacity values against, so in the first diagram on the left here, we fix the input dimension D, and we vary this temperature multiplied by the energy. So these are D, beta, and omega are the parameters for the channel. So in the first plot here, we vary, say, the temperature. And then the Birkenstein bound is given by this diagonal line, right? Because Birkenstein bound reads something like beta times omega. And log D is fixed. So this is the horizontal line. And the classical and the quantum capacity are this orange, this blue and orange lines, and we see that these lines are below these two curves, right? So of course the capacity cannot be larger than log D, the input dimension, and also importantly, they never surpass the Birkenstein bound. So we can say that the qubits and the classical bits, C bits, transmitted are constrained by the Birkenstein bound, at least for the unruly channel. So on the right diagram here, we just have a different plot where we fix the Birkenstein bound, we fix beta times omega, but we don't fix the input dimension. The same message, the same conclusion. We see that this blue and orange curve are below the Birkenstein bound. However, this green one, this entanglement-assisted capacity, is at least log D, right? So this thing is not does not obey the bound, and of course, physically, there's nothing to worry about because for Alice and Bob to implement entanglement-assisted to achieve such a rate with entanglement assistance, this means that they have to use bell paths that are freely provided to them in an auxiliary system, right? Say Alice and Bob will share a cavity of clean bell entangled photons before they implement this protocol. So these things are not accounted for in the Birkenstein bound. Therefore, it's not surprising that you can do better with extra help, right? So once you accounted those also into the Birkenstein bound, presumably you will shift up the bound such that this green curve is also below the dashed line. Therefore, a priori is the fact that this green curve here is above bound is nothing to be worried about. Right. Here I just showed the plot, but really for these three quantities, we have analytic formulas. So the main point here is that the qubits and sibits are constrained by the bound. All right. So
can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So I can see a slight difference between the classical capacity and the quantum capacity.
Yes.
Especially as a smaller beta omega.
Yes.
Yes. Do you have any explanation for that?
I don't. So really, I think so. So your observation is very sharp. So the qubit in the infinite temperature limit, the quantum capacity would drop to zero, but the classical capacity would drop to something like one minus the Euler constant, something. So it's like order one quantity, 0.
Mm-hmm.
Less than one. I mean, practically just means almost also nothing, but I don't have a good explanation for why it is. And also another point is that the energy here, the Birkenstein bound here, is not quite exactly beta omega. It's beta omega divided by one minus exponentially small term. The exponentially small term is also it's exponential of minus beta omega. So this means that this dashed line, this bound, also sort of tends towards one instead of zero, and therefore the bound allows the capacity to have this wiggle room at infinite temperature. I would say it's maybe just a feature of the model. There's nothing universal about this behavior. Yeah,
I see. And I have another question.
Sure.
Is the monotonicity under monotonicity of these capacities with respect to beta omega is guaranteed or?
I would say physically yes, but we didn't have a it doesn't obviously follow from any monotonicity from quantum information,
mm-hmm.
but physically I would say. If you increase beta, that means decreasing the temperature, the less noise you have, because the only noise is coming from the onward radiation. If that's not as hot, then you have better chance of getting the you have less noise, right? So I would say physically, it will be very weird if it's monotone. Mm.
That's it. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks for the question. So this channel, it has this feature which is still peculiar. So let's look at high temperature, right? So this is indicated by this red line. So let's look at very small beta, that means high temperature. And here we have a extensive separation. So this means that we have a situation where the classical and quantum capacities can be less than one, and of course positive. But yet the classical the entanglement sister capacity is larger than log d's, right? So there's an extensive separation between these two guys, and also it's not just the ratio are big. It's really the absolute difference between them is big. So if you think about it, this is saying that you have a channel that is so noisy that it, on its own, it's basically useless at high temperature, right? Because Bob just has too much of a difficulty to even distill a single bit or qubit. However, with entanglement systems, suddenly he can read out a lot of classical bits, even a log d amount of them. So there's a huge capacity boost due to the entanglement systems. And this is a bit of surprising because how on earth we know that the entanglement resource alone cannot be used for communication because these are like static resource. So your channel still need to send something in order to facilitate to turn this good resource of entanglement into actual bits, right? So something is still being transmitted by the channel that makes this happen. So we want to figure out what that is. If we think about how usually one would implement the dense coding protocol, and basically to have a entanglement assisted capacity to do this entanglement assisted communication, what one usually do is to do dense coding. So essentially, Alice and Bob they try to use this shared entanglement pair by Alice encoding her message into this entangled state by locally rotating her share of the state, and then she used the quantum channel to send her share of the state to Bob, and Bob will decode twice amount of classical message out of this bell pairs. So this is the essentially the standard dense coding protocol, provided of course if you have a clean qubit, you have the ability to send a clean qubit. So if you have a noiseless quantum channel, a noiseless qubit channel, of course you can do this to achieve the capacity. And this is essentially what happens at very small temperature, right? So if we look at this diagram on the very right, when beta is very large, then this is how you achieve basically 2 log d of a capacity. But now we want to look at the red curve, right? We want to look at the very high temperature limit, and ask why there's still a log d amount of transmission. So perhaps one can use this weaker version of a resource inequality. And this is something sometimes called the zero-bit dense coding protocol. And this basically says, oh, instead of using a qubit, you can use something called a zero-bit, which I'll explain later, that combines zero-bit with the e-bit will actually give you not quite two classical bits, but actually achieve a dense coding protocol of one classical bit. So maybe this is what happens. So now we need to figure out what zero bit is. Right. So roughly speaking, we say a channel transmits d zero bits if any two-dimensional subspace of this 2 to the d dimensional message space can be decoded. This is a bit of a abstract definition. Let's look at a concrete task to make sense of zero bit. So this task is something called the quantum identification task that introduced by Hayden Winter in 2010. In this task, Alice wants. So this is sort of a very primitive information theoretic task. So instead of Alice want Bob to decode the state, in this case, Alice wants Bob simply to identify the state, in the sense that Alice, for any input state that Alice has, she wants Bob to simulate a binary measurement. Okay, so here in this equation, we have a psi state, that's the input state to the channel that Alice chooses. And then she also wants Bob to reproduce the measurement effect of a binary projective measurement phi, and so this is indicated by this projective phi and 1 minus phi here. And what Bob needs to do is to come up with a POVM measurement depending on this phi choice here, and so this POVM measurement is denoted by d of phi and 1 minus d of phi, such that the measurement effect on Bob's side, on the output of the channel, is basically the same as if he's actually with Alice and measured the input of the channel, right? So if Bob has the ability to do that, then you say that this code represented by this encoder and the decoder here. Sorry, I forgot the encoder to the input of the channel, but it should be there. We say that if this can be achieved, we say that this is a the epsilon quantum identification code, right? So if this has been achieved, this means that the channel has the ability to preserve some minimal notion of coherence, such that Bob can identify the state by simply look at the output of the channel. So now the operational definition of zero bits simply means that we say a channel N transmits log D zero bits if for any epsilon there exists a, you know, D to the N epsilon quantum identification code for Alice and Bob to perform this task with multiple copies of the channel, right? So this is the notion of zero bits here. So just like the operational definition for qubits and classical bits, we use this capacity notion to define what we mean by a channel has the ability to transmit certain kind of bits. And here we may say the channel has the ability to transmit zero bits. It really means that Alice and Bob can perform this task with small error. Okay. And this talk, so notice that this task doesn't involve any other communication resources. So if they can do that, that means that they have really a clean zero bits. And this is certainly a quantum task. Intuitively, you should think of zero bits as like a tiny fraction of a qubit. It's less powerful, but more robust against noise. So even though the classical bit and qubit are rare to find, when we have very high temperature, the channel doesn't, you know, the noise destroys them, but the noise are not strong enough to destroy zero bit. And besides quantum identification, they can be used for dense coding, as we just seen in the previous slide, and also many other primitives. Okay, so it turns out that we can you know, look at the capacity formula for zero bit and computed that, and this is shown in the green curve. For the case of our channel, it actually coincides with the formula for the entanglement assisted classical capacity, and this green curve is also the zero bit capacity, so to speak. But now we see that it's indeed true that the channel has the ability to transmit a lot of zero bits in the ID limit, and such that this means this kind of information represented by zero bits, that means Alice and Bob can do quantum identification, this kind of ability are not constrained by the Birkenstein bound. And importantly, in this scenario, there's no entanglement pairs being used here. So no auxiliary system. We have just a simple violation of the bound from the zero bit. If we combine the example we saw before, you simply look at the right diagram and see that when you increase the species number, this green curve just shoots just beyond this Birkenstein bound, right? So you can say that unlike the classical bits and qubits, zero bits do have the species problem, right? So the species problem is just a name. You know, I'm not suggesting here that this is a bad thing, but it's just a feature of zero bit. Right, so the main takeaway is that there's no Birkenstein bound for zero bits because of this very fact that it has this species problem. You can just simply by adding the any kind of reasonable Birkenstein bound will be violated, as we've shown. Right, so I just want to throw in one last slide before I end, is that there's this natural generalization by Hayden Pennington that generalized zero bits to alpha bits, if you ever heard of it. And this is just something interpolates between zero bits and qubits. So alpha is a value between 0 and 1, alpha is 0, it's a zero bit, and alpha equal to 1 is a qubit. And very analogously, now in this case, you ask the channel, right? So if the channel, we say the channel transmit D alpha bits, if a subspace of 2 to the alpha d dimensional size can be decoded out of a 2 to the d dimensional message space. So if this is the case, then you say the channel transmit alpha bits. And I will not give you really a technical definition, but roughly speaking, you know, sending alpha bit means that, you know, your channel is noisy, you don't quite have a qubit, but you can still make good use of the alpha fraction of noisy qubit. If you can do that, you say your channel still transmit alpha bits. And it turns out that these guys are not constrained by the Bekenstein bound either. So we can plot this phase diagram, right? So in this phase diagram, we have the zero bit at the bottom line here and the qubit at the very top. This is the value of alpha in the y-axis. In the x-axis, we have this beta times omega. So you can see that this shaded area means there's no Bekenstein bound for these alpha values at these temperatures, whereas this unshaded area is the region where you do have a Bekenstein bound. So you see that a qubit will always have a Bekenstein bound, right? Always constrained by the Bekenstein bound, but zero bit, at some temperatures you don't have the Bekenstein bound, and similarly for some alpha values in between them. And exactly how this phase time diagram tells you for the Unruh channel, for which values of for fixed value of beta omega, what are the values of alpha bits? What kind of alpha bits admits or doesn't admit Bekenstein bound? Okay, so let's go back to the title. What exactly does Bekenstein bound? And now we can say that for classical bits and qubits, perhaps they do respect Bekenstein bound. We say perhaps because we only study a particular channel. We didn't do a general study for any communication channels. So we know that for general channels, this capacity formula can be super additive. We don't know how to deal with them on a very general level. So we can't really strictly rule out the possibility that these guys could violate the Bekenstein bound. But at least for the Unruh channel, we have evidences that these guys obey the bound. But we can say for sure that the zero bits or alpha bits, they are certainly not constrained by the bound. So that's the main takeaway, and thank you very much.
Great, thanks a lot. So let's see if there's any questions. I have one question while people think about it. A few things, I guess. I guess one thing is, like, you're seeing that for these particular channels, for this Unruh channel, you don't get a Bekenstein sort of bound on zero bits or certain alpha bits or alpha bits for certain alpha. Is that, like, saying that there's no Bekenstein bound, is that going to mean that there's just no physical bound and I can always cook up situations where I transmit an arbitrarily large number of zero bits? Or is there still, like, some physical constraint on these quantities?
So I say that the claim that I say there's no, there cannot be reasonable Bekenstein bound is because of this fact that in this diagram on the right here, when I increase log D, I can just, so this green curve is unbounded with log D. So any bound you can draw there based on physical reasonings will be surpassed at enough number of species. So the zero bits will always have the species problem. And that for me, I think, is the key reason why you couldn't have a bound. In contrast to, say, this case where the Marov calculation, they show that the entropy doesn't have the species problem. In the literature, the species problem was one of the first concerns that people raised to argue against the Bekenstein bound, and this was resolved for at least for the entropy case by these guys. So I think if we borrow that criteria here, We learn from the unruly channel that at least for the unruly channel, this cannot be the case. And then as a counter example, you just need one channel to argue that generally maybe you cannot hope. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I guess one other thing. So could you hope to prove something like a Bekenstein bound for say cbits or qubits if you say restrict yourself to additive channels, or like for some, like is there some class of channels you could argue this for beyond the unruh channel?
So I think formally one can just take this formulas like the coherent information or the whole level quantity. So that would be something of a spirit of the form that the Busso did, right? So he just look at this whole level quantity and try to put a bound here. But I should add that this first part is universal, but this second part, equality here, really in this case relying on the fact that your encoding is also like the unitary encoding, so these encodings don't change the margin, the entropy of the reduced states. If you don't have that, then you can have upper bound that is also information theoretic rather than physical. So this second relation here is unclear. I think it's an interesting question, but I don't have a we spent some time on this on trying to have a universal bound, but we couldn't get there.
I see Debbie has a question. Do you want to unmute yourself?
Yes. So the effect that you can have a channel that has very little classical or quantum capacity, but a large entanglement assisted capacity has been observed before. That's in 2009 by Smith and Smolin on a channel called the Rocket Channel. It's quite a neat result because there they not only show that the entanglement assisted capacity is large, but if you throw in any assistance, it can be back classical channel, erasure channel on the side that has no capacity on its own, the 50-50 erasure channel. Or entanglement. So all three resources that have no capacity on their own will boost the capacity of the rocket channel from a very small value to, again, a log D or half log D, a third of a log D worth.
I see.
And I do not see that construction has anything to do with zero bits.
I see.
Maybe the connection is deeper, or maybe in the unruh channel, you can also consider these other resources, the back assisted classic capacity or the 50-50 ratio channel.
I see. Yeah, I didn't know that example. We're looking for examples in the future. I didn't find that one, but maybe I should look at that one and see if
has the title extensive non-additivity of privacy.
I see.
Because the classical capacity is no bigger than 2 for d-squared dimensional version, and then the erasure channel has no capacity privacy. And that's why they call it that way. But it's actually a result on boosting many, many different capacities from a very low value, but not 0-0. That's why it's not called super activation either. The channel has a certain amount of capacity, which is very low.
I see.
And then you add the zero capacity as resource on the side, and the numbers become very high.
So you say that you don't see a relevance of zero bits in their channel?
I do not know yet. I was wondering about it. And of course, it's easy to set up a meeting to chat a little longer between two. Like, Graham is here now, and to investigate a little further. Yeah.
I see. Yeah, thanks for the comment. I will look at that. Yeah. Thanks.
Ricardo, you have a question?
Yes. Thank you for a very interesting talk. I have a question. I missed the first 20 minutes, so maybe you've already explained that, but so in your setup, you consider some local observer, right?
Yeah, so at least say the Bob is yeah, Bob is locally accelerating and he can see the entire wedge by, you know, formally something like his domain of dependence or time-like tube theorem, whatever. So he has the ability to send probes to probe the entire wedge. Yes, let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, actually, it sounds very similar to what I'm doing right now. Here, I'm basically calculating the locally accessible information for some subregion in the for quantum fields. And my question is it possible to extend your analysis to the case of some smeared observer, or ultimately for some subregions, and I mean some quantum reduced density matrix for some quantum fields? Is that possible?
Well, I would say that if you have a if you can formulate a precise channel, then you can in principle carry out the same analysis. But my worry is just that for general channel, if you formulate this way, it might be hard to tell whether it has these nice properties of being additive and so on. And generally, it may not be additive. So then, yeah, then it's just difficult to find a bound on the capacities, in particular, you want an upper bound, right? Because so here the Auro channel, it's important that say if we pick a Minkowski mode for Alice, that will be a natural thing to do, and for Bob is of course still the Rindler mode. Then this channel is nasty to work with, so we don't know how to do that. So that's why we have to pick this Auro mode, which, you know, less physical for Alice, but as a proof of principle, this makes the channel much easier to analyze. In particular, it has additive capacities. So I would say it's difficult to find this sweet point where you want a channel that has these physical bearings and also can be analyzed by quantum information tools. You know, it has the ability to not just prove theorems, but has the ability to actually calculate these quantities. So the sweet point is maybe difficult to find technically. But yeah, but I would say that you can formulate this question certainly. Yeah.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah, so I'll encourage everyone to reach out to Jinzhao over email and maybe set up meetings to chat further. Yeah, he's unfortunately not here in person, but maybe we'll visit sometime, and in the meantime, you can always get him on Zoom. Yeah, and so if there's no other questions, I'll remind you that we'll meet in the bistro for lunch, and yeah, that maybe let's thank Jinzhao once more.